basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-point stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fade away.
Giants for the win. James puts up the three. Oh, it's good!
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in! With 5 tenths of a second remaining!
What's up, Laker fans? You're listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius. And today we continue our discussion on the Lakers offseason with a bit of news. Today, Dan Wiecke reported that multiple sources around the league expect the Brooklyn Nets to offer Austin a max contract, which would be 4 years, $178.5 million, which I think is 44 and a half or so per year on average. Lots to talk about between that. I want to talk some player options today a little bit later. But first, what's your reaction to that report?
Yeah, it's always interesting to me because the anonymous sourcing stuff, and I trust Dan's reporting, and I know that this is the way that things work. You don't have to give me your name, but I'll use you to sort of get news out there, which is valuable news. I trust that Dan, just from a, let's move to the reporting side of this just for a second. There are some people who I trust and there are people who I trust less or don't trust at all. Dan's in the list of people where I trust his reporting. I trust he's doing the due diligence. I trust that he's not propping something up that's much smaller in order to get aggregated or make news.
Good way of putting it. Yeah, he's not trying to sell us a bill of goods on that. But that also doesn't necessarily make it true, right? You always talk about how this is lying season, right? And people lie to reporters all the time or have an agenda in talking to them in the first place.
There is always the piece of what's expected to happen around the league is not what always comes true.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because you and I have these conversations all of the time about how groupthink can inform news media reporting, even to the point where groupthink informs who makes All-NBA teams and who wins NBA awards.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, well, we think this is what's going to happen, or important person X says something, important person Y says the same thing, and suddenly a bunch of less important people who are QRS and T, they are like, the people I look up to are saying this, and I think that's probably true, and then suddenly you get consensus out of nowhere. That said, Pete, Austin Reeves is one of the better free agent prospects on the market, just in terms of age and skill set and everything else.
Probably the best unrestricted guy overall.
And so with that being the case, I expect there to be demand for his services. And before he got hurt last year, he was flirting with playing at an all-NBA level. I don't know if he would have made an all-NBA team, but he was clearly in the mix to be an all-star and was rightfully being looked at as one of the 15 or 20 players playing the best in the league. And when you're 27 years old and play a premier position and offer shot making and shot creation skills that Austin does, this is super valuable. We're seeing the value of that over and over and over again in the playoffs. I'm not saying he's as good as Jalen Brunson or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander or on and on and on down the list, but I can guarantee you, you need a guy like this if you're going to be good on offense in the NBA. So I get it. The pocket watching piece of this is always something that is hard for me because we live in an era now of fandom where we put on our GM hats and it's very easy to say like, oh, that's too much money for player X and player Y. I used to ultimately disregard all of that stuff, Pete, but with the aprons structure now and how that can actually impact team building, this sort of stuff does matter to me a little bit more. Because if you end up hard capped for whatever reason or end up being close enough to the second apron, those are like the third rail. No one wants to touch those worlds. Where's your head at around the sheer mass of that number? It's just a huge, huge number for him.
Yeah, I think the first place I go is how credible is the threat of Brooklyn offering that? I have some skepticism for two reasons. One, they drafted four guards in the first round last year. That doesn't preclude you from signing a guard in free agency, but it almost certainly really hinders a couple of those guys' development. You know, you got Yegor Jomin and Saraf and Powell and Traore, I think were the four guys that they drafted, all super young. The Nets won 20 games last year, and Sean Marks had a quote a couple years ago talking about how pursuing max level talent, like they don't want to lock themselves into a six or seven type of seed. Now, I think it's a little different when you're able to sign an unrestricted free agent. That might have been in the context of, hey, we should trade our draft picks for this max level player. And because they've got a lot of those, they've been accumulating that over the last few seasons. And at some point, they're going to spend that. And Marx's point was that, hey, we don't want to do that until that gets locked in. So maybe that's a little bit different with a free agent type of signing. But to your point about the aprons, D, that like a lot of their cap space gets taken up at that point. They're basically an Austin Reeves, Michael Porter Jr. team that can maybe trade for somebody else at that point.
The thing I will say, though, too, Pete, about having a bunch of guys who you just drafted, and this is not necessarily tied to the, I think, excellent point that you made that positionally, there's overlap there. And what do you do? The players who you draft, they're cost controlled and cheap for a long time. Mm-hmm. We just had this conversation about the Spurs. Whatever you think of De'Aaron Fox and however his playoffs are going now, the fact is you can afford to pay him whatever he's making on whatever extension you just signed him to, because your three actual best players combined make less money than he makes.
Crazy.
And they're going to continue to make that. And so you can pay Austin Reeves $40 million and Michael Porter Jr. $30+ million and basically say, yeah, well, combined the four rookies that we just drafted or five rookies that we just drafted, combined they're going to make $25 or $26 million. And it's going to be like that for four seasons, basically. It gives you flexibility within your payroll structure to go out and pay a guy a ton of money and not really feel the real effects of that from an apron standpoint, right? Because those guys, if they were to sign extensions, aren't going to kick in for three more years. If you're on the OKC timeline where suddenly those bills are coming due and you're like, well, now our roster is super expensive, that's when it is tricky to pay a guy like Austin maybe $45 million. But to me, Pete, it's more, is that the step you want to take with your team at this stage? And that's an answer like, I don't know when it comes to the Nets, right? Like, are they tired of being awful?
A listener had asked the other day about Michael Porter Jr. You know, we were talking about Markkanen and Murphy, and he was like, hey, I thought you might bring up Michael Porter Jr. He fits this bill. Totally does. Same type of forward. The reason I didn't include him in that discussion is that I don't think he's on the market. I think that they're looking to keep him, and I think they're looking to improve. And on that front, it isn't an all or nothing type of thing from a team building standpoint of the Nets are all of a sudden going to go from a 20-win team to a team that's contending for something significant beyond a top six or seven seed, which is exactly what Mark said he didn't want to be locked into. You have to build your team incrementally. And so that's an argument for, we know we've still got some work to do, but we've got Austin at 44 and a half a year. We've got Michael Porter Jr. at 40 a year. Claxton's at 23 and 21 next year. They've got Mann on the books a little bit, but pretty much everybody else is at that low contract. They've got one of the healthier situations in the league. And so they very well could go out there and say, hey, we just want to add talent to our team, get better with Austin. This isn't the last move that we're going to make. But I do think assessing how credible the threat is, I'm a little bit skeptical, but it's certainly credible enough to talk about. Let's go to break here. I've got a question for you on the other side of it. So when we talked about this the other day about whether or not Austin would be back, you expressed a little bit of concern and reticence about paying Austin this exact type of number that we were talking about. And so let's say it's June 30th or whenever the negotiations open up and you look down at your phone and you're Rob Pelinka and you see Aaron Riley's number on the phone and he says, Rob, we've got an offer from the Nets. For 4 years, 178 and a half, so 44 and a half million or so per year. Austin's yours if you can match it. What do you say to him?
I'd say I'm totally willing to pay him $178 million. Let's do it over 5 years instead of four, and I'll give you the same money.
No, I have an offer for 4 years, $178.5 million, and we're going to walk if you offer me 5 years, $178 million.
At that point, I would have a real conversation internally about what I wanted to do. One of the trickier things in this collective bargaining agreement is paying a non-max player max money. I think that that's always been true to a certain amount, that it will always hamper your team building. But mostly the penalties that came from that were in the form of like tax dollars and repeat tax stuff. And so it was just more money.
Yeah. And it's like, who cares if the owner is willing to spend? You want your owner to spend. There's no like implications to how you were able to build your team aside from their willingness to spend. Not the case anymore.
The restrictions that come with the first apron of not being able to take back more money than what you trade, and like other restrictions that come from that, the stuff that comes with the second apron, non-aggregation of contracts and trades, not being able to take back a dollar more in trades, what happens to trade exceptions, and there's just like draft picks getting frozen. The second apron essentially serves as a hard cap, and you don't go into the second apron unless you're confident that you can be a championship level team. And we are very capable of winning the title like that season, that you're going to be in the second apron. The Celtics did this, Pete. They were, I think, a second apron team. They won the championship. And then after that, the year after, they were willing to be a second apron team again. Their best player gets hurt, and then they tore it all down, and they're just like, no more for us. We're no longer going to be a championship level team with Tatum hurt, and we're going to sell off players. And that dynasty window that was supposed to be the Celtics, remember, they were the team. Look at the young talent. Mm-hmm. Look at all these guys. That went up in smoke. After 18 months, it was over. This is where I am reticent of saying, well, I'm going to pay you $40-something million. The thing I would do, too, is I would, and this is just me from an outsider position, I would question Austin Reeves as a competitive player, honestly.
Really? For taking the money?
Not from a money perspective, Pete, but
Brooklyn? Like that type of thing? You're going to go to Brooklyn to do?
You're going to go take a bad team's money.
Mm-hmm.
In the same Wiki report, it was like, you know, the Pistons are also potentially a threat, or Atlanta is also potentially a threat. Like they can do some maneuvering in order to try to create cap space to make a competitive offer, I think was the language that Dan used. And maybe that's not a max offer, but maybe they get close there, right? If you're talking $44 million from the Nets, or $42 million or $40 million from the Hawks, or even the Pistons, for example, I might be like, oh, okay, well, those teams are playoff teams. The Pistons were the top seed in the East.
Mm-hmm.
I would feel way more like, no, man, like go get your bag and do that. Oh, you want to go take all the money from a team that won 20-something games and has been awful? Basically, for the better part of a decade. Like, okay, man, I get it. I get it. Again, I'm never going to say that players should make less, or they should take less money, or they're not worth the contracts that they get. That's not where I'm coming from. But you know how in the past I've talked about a player's development and what they say they're going to do on the court. But then I'm like, I'm always saying, well, show me. Right? Show me that you're going to make the extra rotation. Show me you're going to box out and hit the glass. Show me you're going to take better care of the ball. These are the knocks on you as a player, and you're telling me that you've changed? Show me. And part of the thing about like winning to me is, or what matters to you is like, show me. Because if you're going to tell me, well, I'll go get all the money in the world, but from a team that won 20 games next year, or I can maybe get close to that amount of money, or whatever, close enough to that money, but play for a team that has a chance to contend for a championship, well, then show me what actually matters to you. And if Austin or his agents are basically just like, well, we're going to walk, okay, I guess, then go play for the Nets.
Well, where does that leave the Lakers, right? Like, because you've only got the $20.9 million cap hold, right? Now, and so that's the response, right? Like, that's the thought, is that, hey, does Austin have the Lakers over a barrel a little bit? Because you do not get $44.5 million of cap space. Now, I agree with your point of view, and I'll give my perspective in a second. But, like, oh, you know, you're talking about it from a show me, from Austin's point of view, like, it can be a little bit of cutting off your nose to spite your face if you take that approach of, like, where does that leave the Lakers at the end of that?
I'm not trying to, like, lose Austin Reeves for nothing. And I value Austin Reeves, and I want him back. One of the things that I truly believe in, too, Pete, is that negotiations that go a certain way never really leave the ether of the relationship that exists.
Kuminga?
Just everything. And we've seen this multiple times within sports, but I would argue even within, like, personal relationship stuff. Like, if you go to your boss and you're like, I deserve a raise, and your boss is just like, yeah, I get it, but no. And you're like, I love working here. I think you're a great boss, but my value is this, and this is what I think. And they're like, I get it. I really do value you, but no, we're not in a position to do that. Over time, I don't think you ever forget that aspect of things. And for me, I think my preferred outcome for both the Lakers and Austin is that they come at him with a fair number, and Austin feels appreciated by that fair number. And that's the nature of their quote unquote negotiation, right? Is, we want you back.
Mm-hmm.
You say you want to stay. This is a ton of money. Let's do it and shake on it and make a deal. The I'm going to go get every last cent of things. Like, if that's what you want, okay. But if you don't get it from us, then if you want to go get it somewhere else, I just feel like there is a threshold to things. But maybe I'm, like, taking too hard of a stance with this, because, again, I don't want to lose Austin Reeves for nothing. So your point definitely is, like, stabbing me in the ribs a little bit, like, hey, dummy. What are you doing here?
So let's talk about that. What are the Lakers' alternatives if they come to the Lakers and be like, well, what we think is a fair number is 45 a year, basically what another team can offer as a max deal. Do you view him as that? And that's what it's going to take to be able to keep him. To put it simply, and I want to explain far more about my thought process on this on the other side of the break, I'd rather pay Ayo Dosunmu 20-something million dollars than Austin 45 a year. That doesn't mean I think Io's a better player than him, but I think Ayo plus $25 million over time. Now, that doesn't matter this offseason, but it would matter in future ones. And I think that that style of player is a better fit anyway. And so I want to go to break here, though, and sort of take a big picture view of my rationale of that. One of the things I hear a lot about building a team around Luka Doncic is, hey, we want to simulate what the 2024 Mavs were, build a team that's sort of like that. And while I get that that's the best team that Luka's had, they didn't actually win. And I don't think that that is even close to the only way that you could or should look to build around Luka. I'm of the opinion that you don't actually need a second lead guard if you've got Luka on the team. If you look at the Knicks, there's no second guy that's a perimeter ball handler that makes a ton of money. Same thing with OKC. This is actually a fairly rare thing to have two players that are both off the dribble perimeter guys. And when you do, it's like Harden and Mitchell, for example. And you hope the Lakers are able to be better than that with Luka as the best guy. But when they did that with Dallas, it was also Jalen Brunson and Kyrie Irving. And Austin isn't that level of on-ball creator. And so you would have to, I believe, have a better surrounding cast of defensive players and athletes to be able to bridge that gap. Like, I know they got to the finals, but they got whooped in those finals. And part of it was because Kyrie couldn't put the ball in the hoop because he wasn't quite good enough. That's part of my argument for, like, if, and I don't believe you need to, it wouldn't be my choice to have Luka and then mini Luka, but if you're going to go a two ball handler type of route, the second dude has to be amazing also for it to work, I believe. Also, jump shooting is an issue. Austin's an inconsistent jump shooter. It's been, I think, four straight playoff series where he shot under 33% from three. In the vast majority of high-level playoff circumstances, I want Luka to have the ball. And so I don't think that you need this type of point guard in the first place. But if you do, there needs to be a certain level of unimpeachable offense. That one of the things that was mentioned in the Wyke article was that the Lakers front office believes that the concerns about their defense are overstated, the Luka and Austin combo. And I think there's some merit to that. I do think that both players provide something on the defensive end that's more than, they're not just turnstiles. However, both guys do get targeted, right? Like they're in the game, they're making what they make, not to be great defenders, but because of how good they are on offense. My argument is that they are not good enough as a duo on offense. Like, we got killed by OKC in San Antonio this year, and trying to initiate offense in that way did not work. You need other guys that can contribute and put the ball on the hoop. But you were talking the other day about how the Knicks salary structure is sort of a template for what the Lakers can do. They don't have guys on rookie contracts, but they do have like one guy at 50, one guy at 40, one guy at 30, or a couple guys at 20, along those lines, right? Luka's our $50 million guy, basically. He makes 49. Then if Austin is in the 40s, and you were making this point the other day, like, I don't care who's making what, just as long as it adds up to a championship caliber team. And if Austin's making that number, but you've got the surrounding cast, awesome. Make all the money that you can. But that would require somebody in the 30s or 20s to be able to be really, really good at their jobs. And if you're evaluating it similar to the Knicks, like, I think everybody except for Bridges is better at their particular job on the Knicks than what Austin is in that lead guard type of role. So if you're going to pay that type of guy to do that type of job, like, I think he's got to be elite at it.
The point I was trying to make the other day about the Knicks as well is that their third highest paid player is technically their best player.
Yes.
And so, like, when I was making the point about it doesn't really matter to me if Austin's the guy who's in the 40s versus the guy who's in the 30s. The caveat that is a big caveat that comes with that, though, is can the player who's in the 30s be a better player than Austin Reeves, right? Because if Austin is your second best player overall, I think that you are going to be challenged to win an NBA championship. People were proclaiming Victor Wembanyama the best player in the league before the finals started.
I'm still proclaiming that, but yeah.
Yeah, and fine. He makes $11 million. So look, it comes in all shapes and sizes and salary slotting. Like, you don't need to make the most money in the league to be the best player. There's a shit ton of ways to show your value. And like, I would argue what Jalen Brunson did for the Knicks was showing the ultimate value of, look, guys, like, I get it. In the team building construct of this year and what our plan is to build the best team possible, I'm totally happy to take less than what my max is in order to make this structure of this team work. And look, that's a different situation, you could say. Like, Brunson's known Leon Rose for a long time, and his dad is a coach on the staff. Some of the players that they acquired were his best friends from college who won championships with him at the college level. It's like, that's not necessarily what's happened with Austin here. But I think the point is that Brunson did take that 1,000-foot view that you were zooming out from as well and saying, all right, well, building the best team possible, this is my contribution to that. And it's a ton of money. Jalen Brunson's underpaid. He's great, and he doesn't make the max. But in the end, he does make a ton of money, and he's like, okay, I'm happy playing basketball here in this place. And I'm wondering how true that is for Austin.
But Austin spent his entire career making less money than he was worth, right?
Jalen Brunson not make less money than what he was worth, too? Like, I don't understand.
No, the point that I'm making is that Austin's never gotten a big payday from all of this, right? So that idea that Austin needs to prove that he will take less, or like, he's been an underpaid player his whole. Now, again, what I care about is the Lakers and the team that ends up there. What I'm saying is, like, I don't have any expectation whatsoever of them looking to take a little bit less on this contract, in part because that's what he's done his whole career so far.
I get it, but these are technicalities to me. Austin made as much as he could possibly make from the Lakers. They gave him every cent that he could possibly get. The fact that he didn't get a deal that was bigger than that in free agency is really on his agents. Like, they didn't get that massive offer sheet from any team that the Lakers would have had to have matched. And so, look, like, I'm replaying what I'm saying in my own head as I'm talking. And I just want to continue to reiterate, like, Austin should make as much money as he can get. That's fine by me. It's also fine by me, though, if he decides that he really does want to make every last cent that he could get, that it may not be on the Lakers, and it may not be best for the Lakers to actually do that for him.
That's a super important thing to zero in on, D, is that, like, I think the Lakers need to have a walk-away point. My threshold is tradable to other teams, right? I don't know what that number is, but if it doesn't work out, you can move him and not be in a place where you're, like, stuck with a bad contract that nobody wants.
Yeah, and I don't know what that number is for other teams when it comes to Austin. I know that at any given time, there's probably anywhere between 5 and 15 really max players. And there's probably 50 players who actually make the max.
Also, the maxes are different, too. Like, the terminology, like, a Giannis max is a way different thing than a Austin Reeves max.
It is. 25% of the cap versus 35% of the cap, right? And that's the difference between what Austin makes and what Giannis makes, or what Jaylen Brown is about to make in his extension that he signed with Boston. I think for me, the biggest balance for roster building is not just a point that you made about, is it a tradable contract? It's, does this infringe on the Lakers' ability to continue to improve the team with additional sort of value level contracts while having the flexibility against the aprons that they want to have? I don't necessarily care about being a first apron team, for example. If you feel like your roster is pretty much set and your ability to improve on the margins isn't truly compromised to a degree where there's no possible moves out there for you at all. And Austin on a $40 million deal, like, doesn't necessarily do that. It doesn't compromise you so much. But the point you were making earlier, and I want to really hammer this point home because I think it's important, is that the most important position, I think, right now, besides Luka and Austin, is a front court player that is better than Austin Reeves. And I'm putting LeBron to the side within this discussion because his future with the Lakers is not only tenuous, but it's also no longer than like a year at the most where you would expect him to be able to say that he's actually better than Austin Reeves. I don't expect Austin at 28 to be a worse player than LeBron at 43. For example, like, if we were to fast forward.
I don't know, man. I just watched these playoffs, and for all of the Austin's the number two guy and all of that, he was certainly behind LeBron in the pecking order when the real basketball started. He just came back from injury. I get that.
Yes. And
I don't think that's the reason for it, though. I don't know, man.
I don't think it's the only reason, but I think it's a reason.
Sure.
Right? But I'm putting LeBron to the side within this. I'm talking about the next great Lakers team. And a great team is not a team that is only around for one season. I think the Lakers need to forecast and say, how can we be a championship contending team over the life cycle of our best player's contract? And if that's with Austin making a ton of money, that's fine. But getting that player that I think is better than Austin for the lifespan of Luka's contract, I think is super important.
I have a difficult time imagining a team with Austin as a second best player. Like, just go through the teams that win championships throughout NBA history. It's hard to picture that.
And again, it's hard because I don't want to just act as though, like, the Lakers are in a position to do what the Knicks just did. The Knicks spent multiple years building a team that is now ready to cross the threshold.
Yep.
And they're one win away from winning the championship. But that took a long time. It started with Julius Randle, right? And
absolutely.
Then came Brunson, and then it was a trade for Josh Hart, and then it was like a massive trade for Bridges, and then Ananobi, and then a trade of Randle for Towns. It's just like they made so many incremental moves to like improve their roster that it's probably not realistic to say, oh, all in one offseason, you're going to do
totally.
This, right?
100%.
But you have to make the right decisions each time, Pete.
And there is no equivalent of a oh, we did this and we lost LeBron, but got way better. There's no Knicks equivalent of that. They did all of those incremental moves. Then they lost a couple of times in the playoffs and tasted their own blood. And now they're at that point where they're a win away from a championship. So this is a multi-year process for a team like that, that doing that, even if you weren't losing a talent like LeBron in 1 year, is probably unrealistic. It can be easy to sort of overlook the LeBron piece. And that's a step back in the playoffs. If you lose LeBron, if he's not on the team, like, going to be very, very hard to improve that much, you know?
Yeah, and this is where, just look at the teams who have won the title in the last handful full of years. They almost all had to make one or two moves at the very end to get them over the top, whether it's like Hartenstein and Caruso to OKC, whether it's Holiday and Porzingis to Boston, whether it's Aaron Gordon to Denver, even. The Denver team that the Lakers beat in the bubble to the finals had Paul Millsap and Jeremy Grant playing power forward, right? And it wasn't until they got Gordon where they really started to be like, oh, wait, no, this is a different deal for them now. And so the LeBron piece of this, when it comes back to building the Lakers out, and the Austin piece of this, and finding a longer-term replacement as a superior front-court talent that can slot in between Luka and Austin, I think is a critical part of the Lakers' offseason planning. And LeBron can be a part of that equation in the short term, but in the long term, he can't be. And right. I think the Lakers have to take a team building approach to the idea that LeBron is additive on top of like the great team we're trying to build, rather than, no, LeBron is a critical piece of this team that we need as a driver in order. If that's the approach that they're taking, which I don't think it is, I'm just saying that if that's the construct of your roster build, I think you're going to fall short again. And this Austin piece is a part of that. And my hope is that both sides see that, understand it, and they sort of meet in the middle there, where it's just like, he's still making a ton of money, but it's not the, all right, man, 240 something million dollars, cough it up now, because if you don't, then we're walking. It's just like, all right, well, we're kind of in a contentious place already.
Sure.
This just started.
Lots of stuff going on. Things starting to heat up. I think we're going to get a lot of moves around the draft, around the league. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But everybody have a good weekend. Until then, you've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
And Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. And the Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound is lobbed. 3 seconds left. Van Exel to win it. It's on the way. Good.
Kobe Bryant. 48 points. 16 rebounds. Shaq with his 8th block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
in Boston. Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe, hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Ready pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move. Two, one.
Miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable. It's over.
Shot clock now to 5. Bryant.
Yes.
And that was a little tap to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis, 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good! Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers! James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.
As the U.S. men's national team takes center stage at a home World Cup,
Make sure you're listening to Call It What You Want, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can join me, I'm Jimmy Conrad, alongside Charlie Davies, Tony Miola, Marcelo Balboa, and Benny Feilhaber throughout this tournament for previews, instant reactions, and analysis of every U.S. match. Then all summer, we're back every Tuesday and Thursday, covering all things U.S. Men's National Team. Download and follow Call It What You Want on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.